In law enforcement, there are those who carry big sticks and those who talk softly. Clint Van Zandt was among the latter. He used to be the FBI's chief hostage negotiator. Hostage negotiation is the psychological umbilical cord between the good guys and the bad guys, a connection that can save or cost lives. In his 25-year career, he encountered Ted Kaczynski, Timothy McVeigh, and spoke at length with David Koresh. His work took him from the very, very personal, an 18-hour standoff with a father who had kidnapped his own child, to the eminently political, the kidnap of an American oil executive in Manila. In his new book, Facing Down Evil, Clint Van Zandt tells a gripping story of one of the toughest bureau jobs there is, and how to protect yourself if you become a victim. Later in the hour, 9/11 conspiracy theories. We'll talk about why they gained traction and hear Popular Mechanics' account of why they're myths. But first, if you have questions about the mindsets of hostage takers and kidnappers, join the conversation. Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. The email address is talk@npr.org. Clint Van Zandt, the author of Facing Down Evil on Life on the Edge as an FBI Hostage Negotiator, joins us today from our bureau in New York. If the name sounds familiar, he was one of the regulars here in the weeks following September the 11th. Clint, nice to talk to you again.
Neil, it's good to be back with you. Thank you.
Obviously, you've had a very long and interesting career. One of the most gripping accounts in your book starts with a phone call in your Virginia home at midnight, a call that took you to Sperryville, Virginia.
Yeah, Neil, those are situations that happen so many times. I mean, in the FBI, you've long since give up on an 8-to-5 job. And in that particular case, I had been out for the evening, got home, barely climbed into bed, and it was the FBI's commander of the hostage rescue team who told me that there had been an ongoing kidnapping investigation, that a man in the Connecticut area had kidnapped his former common-law wife and their child at gunpoint, had carried them down to the Sperryville, Virginia area, which is an area I would go to pick apples with my kids. I mean, it was just a very quiet, peaceful area. Mm-hmm. And now he was holding them at gunpoint, threatening to kill them in the second floor of a barn or a farmhouse in Sperryville. And it was, the usual question is, how quick can you get here? You're the hostage negotiator.
Mm-hmm. And the standoff lasted certainly long enough for you to get there. And there was a curious incident. Some of the SWAT guys, armed, went into the house halfway up the stairs and then saw the suspect coming down the stairs with a rifle pointed at them and his hostages.
You know, this is one of the reasons why we always try to train SWAT team members, hostage rescue team members. We try to give them, you know, just enough hostage negotiations training to make them a little dangerous, or at least to get them out of a life-threatening situation. That's how that original confrontation took place, as I explained in a book, that they were simply clearing the farmhouse. They cleared the first floor. They were going up to clear the second floor to make sure there was no one there. And as they were going up, out of a door comes the suspect. He's got his arm wrapped around the neck of his former common-law wife. He's holding their infant, their young son, with a rifle laid over the shoulder of her, pointing at the agents. And he had them cold. And, of course, the challenge is when you're facing a gun, as you're coming up the stairs, the hostage is standing in front of the guy with the gun. You couldn't shoot if you had to. And now, how do you gracefully back down a set of stairs without getting yourself shot or someone else?
Mm-hmm. And as you point out in the book, the guy going back down the stairs got the barrel of his rifle caught in the slots on the stairway. This standoff goes on for quite some time, and eventually you come to the decision. There's this interesting discussion you have with the tactical leader. You're not in charge there. You're not the person in charge. You're the negotiator. There's another person who's in charge of the tactical teams, the SWAT guys, and then there's somebody else in charge. But eventually you come to this sort of ongoing thing where you think of the tactical guys as, knuckle-dragging gorillas, and they think of you as social workers.
Yeah, and it really works like that a lot of times. You know, it's never like it is on television or the movies. My children always used to say, "Dad, it's no fun going to the movies with you because you always sit there and pick these things apart." And I tell my kids, "Well, it's not real. They don't do it realistic." But in this particular case, we had to make a decision. I had formed an opinion over the night and into the next morning that this individual presented a significant threat to his two hostages. I felt that he was very serious with his threats to kill them. Now, we didn't realize that he had already raped this woman at gunpoint twice during the night and threatened to kill her. So this next morning, the analytical process, Neil, was unique. When you're, I can recall clear as it was that day, standing there in this very nice setting, this forum setting. The overall commander, the FBI special agent in charge, the commander of the tactical team, and myself. And normally you'd see a negotiator saying, you know, we got to wait, let's talk longer. But, you know, you've got to know when to hold them and know when to fold them. And as a negotiator, I had to know when, if I went longer, I was going to start losing hostages. So I had to make the case. I had to present the psychological profile, the threat assessment of this individual, of my absolute belief that if we didn't resolve the situation tactically, that he, in fact, would, in my belief, kill the woman and kill the child. And so the three of us stood there and made a decision to take a human life. And Neil, there was, I don't care whether you're an FBI agent or police officer, I don't care what you do your entire career, when you make a decision to take a human life, there is no more important, no more solemn duty or responsibility that I think a person has.
In the event that decision is made, it's acted on, and it's very skillfully executed by one of the snipers there. The lives of the hostages are saved. The man is killed. And afterwards, you have a conversation with your wife on the phone, and she says, how'd it go? And you said, well, a man died. And she said, did you kill him?
And you know, it's interesting because I had to think, well, it wasn't my finger on the trigger. I didn't use that, you know, 1 pound of trigger pull. I didn't put that 308 round, you know, 60 yards down range and into this man's head. But the reality was I made the case that we had to do that. And, you know, afterwards, there are always people who would say, but what if you had waited? Well, you know, I talked to the woman after the situation. In fact, when the man was shot, they were walking across an open field. He had his arm around her neck with a knife to her throat. He had the rifle jammed to his head. He had the little boy sitting on his shoulders as they walked across this open field. So the FBI sniper had this very small window of opportunity to take that shot. When the man went down, the woman ran in one direction. The little boy went down. We thought the little boy had been killed. And in fact, a tactical team member picks up the boy and hands him to me. Well, he had defecated in his pants. You know, there I am, the father of three children, and one more time, it's my job to clean up a little boy, but it's not my son, it's this little boy. And later, Neil, we're sitting in a command post, and I'm sitting across from this woman explaining to her why we had to do what we did. I didn't want her to feel guilty. And this little 3-4-year-old boy, Neil, is sitting there, and he's taking his little fist and pounding it in his hand. And that's all he did. And you have to realize that he didn't have the verbal skills to say what happened. He didn't know that a bullet had hit his biological father's head with his legs strapped around the father's head. I didn't have the words to explain it to that little boy. But as I'm trying to explain it to the mother, she says, thank you. She says, thank you for what you did. She said, he jammed the gun in my head and said, goodbye, kitten. And she said, I was waiting for him to squeeze the trigger and kill me, he said. And at that second, your sniper took his life first. So we were that close.
Clint Van Zandt, his new book is Facing Down Evil: Life on the Edge as an FBI Hostage Negotiator. If you'd like to join the conversation, our number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Email us, talk@npr.org. And let's begin with Dan. Dan's calling us from Rochester, New York.
Good afternoon to both of you.
Afternoon.
Yes. So you think it's better to talk first when you have a hostage situation than it is to use force. You see, because you see, next week is the 35th anniversary of the Attica prison uprising. So at first they talked for a few days, you know, then they went in shooting and shot and killed more than 40 people and shot and wounded, you know, hundreds of others. So do you think that in the case of Attica, they should have continued talking instead of going and shooting like the way they did?
Well, you know, we have the benefit of 20/20 hindsight, and the last thing I'm ever going to do is try to explain for myself or anybody else in law enforcement why they did something that took another human life. You like to believe they made the best decision they did, but my philosophy has always been you've got four options in a hostage situation. Mine is contain, isolate, and negotiate. Then you can contain and demand surrender. Then you can use a sniper, or you can do a direct assault on the facility. But again, 85% of the time when law enforcement employs a trained hostage negotiator, 85% plus, those people come out, everybody comes out alive. You know, but sometimes you can have the negotiation skills of a Gandhi and you're not going to get it right. And other times you can have the skills of a chimpanzee and the people throw their hands up. My job as a negotiator is to be a fisherman. And a good fisherman doesn't just have a hook and a worm. He has a tackle box with multiple, in my case, psychological lures. And if one line of reasoning that I put out there doesn't work, then it's my job to change it and do another one and do another one and do another one. I think it's incumbent upon law enforcement in the United States and around the world that you always have to use the talking cure as long as you can. And when you reach that critical point, that juncture where you say people are going to die, then you have to make a decision. Where do we go from here? And many times that is going with the tactical option.
Interestingly, we just have a few seconds left, but the first hostage negotiating situation you had was in Rochester, New York, a situation where a man and his son and two hostages, and in the course of all of this, the hostage takers got distracted, the hostages walked away. In fact, one of the hostage takers walked away and got through police lines. Strange things can happen.
Yeah, they really can. You know, another situation in Rochester, I waited. We had a bank robbery. The guy was barricaded in the bank, and his demand was that I meet him in a parking lot and have a shootout with him. And I kept prolonging, like the last gentleman talked about, I kept trying to stretch it out. I kept trying to talk him past a deadline. And Neil, on that one, he stood a bank teller in front of the door, cut her in half, and blew her through the door. So these are tough calls every time. Not one of them is ever the same.
Dan, thanks very much for the call.
You're welcome.
We're talking with Clint Van Zandt about his 25 years in the FBI, where he was chief hostage negotiator before he left. If you'd like to join us, 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Email us, talk@npr.org. I'm Neil Conan. We'll be back after the break. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're talking today with Clint Van Zandt, the FBI's former chief hostage negotiator. His new book is Facing Down Evil, Life on the Edge as an FBI Hostage Negotiator. If you have questions about, well, these kinds of situations, what to do about them, give us a call, 800-989-8255. Email us, talk@npr.org. In the book, Clint Van Zandt also offers advice on what you should do if you become a victim. Let's get another caller on the line. This is Derek. Derek calling us from Ashland, Oregon.
Hey, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I just recently saw the movie Inside Man, and I heard you say that you pick apart the movies when you're watching them, but I wonder if there's anything realistic about those situations. And then also, I wonder if you have had a situation where psychologically and intellectually you felt that the hostage taker had the upper hand, and if you feel like you're outgunned in that sense, how do you handle that?
Yeah, two good questions. Let me answer the last one first, I guess. Part of the challenge is if you have a hostage taker who has nothing to lose. Let me give you my worst-case scenario. I negotiated with David Koresh when he was with the Branch Davidians at Waco, Texas. I came into that situation 2 weeks into it. But I can recall negotiations one particular night, Koresh and I toe-to-toe over the telephone. He had his Bible out. I had mine because Koresh wanted to speak to an FBI agent who had some knowledge about the Bible. And he would race through the Bible trying to show me where he thought he had the right to have a sexual contact with prepubescent children. And I would turn to that chapter and verse and I'd say, "Would David, read before and read after. It doesn't say that." And he'd say, "Brother Clint, do you know who I am?" I said, David, who do you think you are? And he said, I'm the Christ. And I said, David, you know, in the Bible it talks about Christ being, you know, willing to go the extra mile to save one lost sheep. And I said, you're talking about sacrificing your entire flock. But dealing with Koresh, it was, you got the feeling there wasn't anything you could say that he had already made up his mind. In Koresh's case, in fact, I wrote a paper before the situation had that terrible, terrible ending at Waco, and I said Koresh's master plan is to get the FBI to attack, at which time he will blow the building up, burn it to the ground, and he will kill everybody inside to include the children. And I said, please, FBI, don't let us get sucked in on this. And a week later, I stood there and watched that happen. And, you know, adults can make a decision if they want to commit suicide. It's a terrible thing. But when children die, that's, you know, I'm a parent. I'm a grandparent. When those children died, part of me died. And as far as the movie Inside Man, I saw it too. You know, it was a good movie. I like the actors in it. What the movie, I think, portrays well is the psychological chess game that's going on. And as a hostage negotiator, I had to look at it like that. I had to be as unemotional as possible, but I always had to try to think 2-3 moves in front of the hostage taker. Where is he going next, and where is he going after that? And I wanted to be in the position psychologically. I wanted verbally. I wanted to anticipate where he was taking me. Something like when you testify in court and you see the defense attorney is trying to take you down a road, take you to someplace and challenge your testimony. You have to anticipate that. Well, as a hostage negotiator, you're trying to have that same anticipation, but in that situation, if you're right, you're right, and if you're wrong, usually somebody dies.
Were you successfully duped?
You know, in the case of David Koresh, I don't think I was. I think I made the right call. I told the FBI. I mean, my solution to Waco was let's put a 15-foot chain-link fence around the Branch Davidian compound. Let's get all the FBI, ATF agents out of here. Let's put some buses out front. Let's have the marshals manning the gates. Let's get all of the television and radio networks out of here. Let's stop this media circus and tell the Branch Davidians whenever they're ready to come, here's a video that shows the apartment complex that we're going to move you into, and then if you get prosecuted, so be it. But otherwise, here's a place where your family will be staying. I wanted to give them life here after Waco, and the government didn't buy into that.
I wish they had. Thank you for the time.
Yeah, thank you, Derek. Given what happened, everybody wishes they'd tried something else other than what they did. Let's see if we can get Ernesto on the line. Ernesto's calling us from Tucson, Arizona.
Good evening. How do you do what you do? What made you want to become a hostage negotiator, and just how do you do it? It sounds like it's incredibly stressful, something that would definitely give you a heart attack or a
And he's got a full head of dark hair. Go figure.
Well, you know, first of all, being an FBI agent is the only thing I ever wanted to do in my life. When I was in grade school, I knew I wanted to be an FBI agent. Now, you know, I'm the first to tell you, as I tell in the book, it was a circuitous path. I mean, I sit before you as somebody with a doctorate degree, but I also flunked out of undergraduate school twice. So, you know, it took me a while to get where I was going to go. And as far as the stress, you know, everybody handles stress and anxiety differently. I guess because my background is in psychology, I always thought that there's got to be a better way than just guns and bullets, that especially the FBI, of all agencies, has a responsibility to be smart. And part of that is not to have Wacos and not to have Tiananmen Square type of confrontations with American citizens. I mean, if there's no other way and you got to go to guns, I guess you got to go to guns. I mean, I carried one for 25 years. I understand that. But I always felt that there was this ultimate responsibility in a part of law enforcement. And as a hostage negotiator, in these type of situations, you got to realize you're the tip of the spear. I mean, I would be involved in these multi-day, multi-week, sometimes multi-month overseas hostage situations. I would go back to the hotel or motel at night. I'd stand in the shower for half an hour, 45 minutes, and I would imagine everything bad that took place that day is kind of a scale on me, and the shower was washing that away, because because the next morning I had to get up. I had to put my game face on. If there were other negotiators, I had to walk in and say, okay, ladies and gentlemen, today's the day. Today's the day that we get everybody out alive. Did I believe that? Probably not, but I had to believe it, and there was no way that I could have the emotions. Like, my wife would challenge me. She would say, how come you can talk killers and crazies into surrendering, and yet you can't get our 15-year-old son to take the trash out? And I said, you know, two different skill sets. I said, I'm emotionally involved in one. The other, I'm professionally involved, and that doesn't allow for emotions.
Thanks for the call, Ernesto.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Let's go to Matt. Matt's calling from Tucson, Arizona.
Good afternoon.
Afternoon.
I was very curious. In dealing, you know, there's that dichotomy of being a law enforcement agent and then being a criminal. I'm just curious how you feel about the people that are in the private sector as far as security, be it from car repossessions to bail bonds to that type of thing. It just seems to me I've known a lot of really nice people in those businesses, but quite often their moral compass gets skewed because they don't have the law enforcement oath to clue to, I suppose.
Well, you know, sometimes people don't follow that oath. Of course, you know, you can get, I guess there's some channels on television, you can watch Dog the Bounty Hunter, you know, chase people across the country and slap cuffs on them. And, I mean, to me, that's kind of theatrics. And, you know, those are kind of wannabes, people who probably wanted to be a cop and maybe were never able to do it. But, you know, like in the FBI, I mean, there have been FBI agents who have been child molesters, who have been burglars, who have been spies. You know, the challenge in law enforcement is like a guy by the name of Parker, who used to be chief of police of the LAPD in the 50s, said. He said, you know, the only problem with choosing people to be police officers, or in my case, FBI agents, is that you have to take them from the human race. And when you do that, they're going to bring baggage with them. And just, you know, even though when I held up my right hand and I swore to uphold the Constitution, I mean, I really meant it. And I meant it all 25 years I was there. You know, you get challenges. I mean, I arrested an armored car robbers one time, and I got $500,000 from them. And we went in the office and we went to count it. And we counted it twice because we'd been up all night and we couldn't get the right amount of money. And the boss says, well, you know, everybody's tired. Let's go home. He says, Clint, what are you going to do with the money? I said, I'm going to throw it under my desk and we'll do it the next day. You know, so there sits $500,000. And, you know, the thought of, gee, my kids need new tennis shoes, or I need a college fund for, you know, I've got three kids that are, I mean, that just wasn't there. I mean, it wasn't my money, you know, and yet some people, you know, if it's, maybe it's not $500,000, maybe $10 million is a greater temptation. I don't know. But, you know, once you say, I have a responsibility, then you have to carry it out, whether it's in a marriage or as a law enforcement officer.
Thanks, Matt.
Thank you.
And let's see if we can get, this is Bart. Bart's on the air. He's calling us from Phoenix, Arizona. A lot of calls from Arizona today.
Yeah.
Bart, you there?
Oh, yes, I am. Thank you.
Go ahead, please.
Oh, yes. Thank you for taking my call. Mr. Van Zandt, I was curious as to far if the media is more of a positive influence or a distraction, or was there a particular case where the media had an impact on the outcome of a situation?
Well, with the stipulation that public radio is always helpful. Clint.
Yes. Absolutely. I'll second that, Neil. Let me preface that with that, in, you know, since my involvement in the Unabomber case shortly after I retired from the FBI, I've probably done 2,500 television interviews and an equal number of media, both radio and print interviews, and I've found out what it's like to be on the other side. But a hostage situation that took place in California at a university, an individual who was distraught went into a college bar, fired a couple of shots, took everybody hostage in there, made the women inside do some bizarre sexual things, was threatening to kill all the hostages, and the police tactical team was going to make an entry into the building to try to deal with this guy. Well, television was live at the time and was showing the police tactical team as they made their approach to the bar. The guy is watching this on the television and the bar, and he sits up with a two-handed hold on his handgun, ready to shoot the officers as they walk through the door. And fortunately, he was 180 degrees off. The door he thought they were approaching was, in fact, behind behind him. The door burst open, he spun, and of course the law enforcement officers dealt with him tactically, shot him and killed him. But that was so close, and so many times you see the media doing that. I mean, when I'm on television, every time I talk about an ongoing situation, I have to preface, number one, we don't want to say anything that's going to hurt the case, and number two, in a hostage situation or a barricade, when I'm on television talking, I talk like a negotiator would. I talk and I say things that I think a hostage negotiator would say to the guy, because I realize the challenge that law enforcement's facing at that time.
And one of the interesting things you said as a principle of hostage negotiation is that you never lie.
No, and I didn't. You know, there's the British SAS, the Special Air Service, their equivalent to U.S. Army Delta Force, is, you know, there should be no lie until the last lie. And, of course, that's when you want him to look left because you're coming right. But as a negotiator, I always realize that, and in fact, I've had it happen before, where you can I've arrested a guy one time and treated him right, treated him just like I would expect to be treated, and 5 years later, he's a hostage taker, and he's holding hostages in a house, the one you talked about, mm-hmm. Neil, where they were held up. And I was able to say, hey, you know, it's me. I'm the guy who dealt with you 5 years ago. I was honest with you then. I'm being honest with you now. Well, I had a track record with him, and he believed me as best I could get him to believe me. So, you know, I think you always have to, you know, if I lie to somebody in a hostage situation, and then a week later, a month later, a year later, law enforcement faces that person again. It's the aha phenomena. The guy says, aha, you fooled me once, but you're not going to fool me again. So I always felt that responsibility that there might be a next time, and I had to support that next situation. And the only time, you know, I mean, you don't lie, you use tactical expressions. But if you have to get him to look left, when you're coming in right, that's when you have to do it. Would I lie to save the life of a hostage? Absolutely.
Yeah. Bart, thanks very much.
I appreciate that. I saw a new show, Standoff, I believe, where the modern technology, the guy's watching the snipers on the roof on TV as he's got the hostage, and that's the world we live in these days. So
I suppose.
You're taking my call. Have a great day.
Thanks, Bart. You too. And Clint Van Zandt, thanks so much for coming in. Good luck with the book.
Neil, thanks for having me.
Clint Van Zandt, his book is Facing Down Evil. He worked for the FBI for 25 years as chief hostage negotiator, as well as a supervisor in the Bureau's Behavioral Science Unit. He wrote the book in collaboration with Daniel Paisner, and he joined us from our bureau in New York. This is Talk of the Nation from NPR News.